Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, are the U.S. Navy's attacks on ships off the coast of Venezuela and Colombia legal? And are they unprecedented? Doug Becker explores the situation alongside modern history.
I'm Doug Becker. As of this recording, this is the third week of October in 2025. The U.S. Navy has killed at least 37 people in attacks on boats that the administration are claiming carry drugs. Most of those attacks have been in the Caribbean, off the shore of Venezuela, though the U.S. Navy is also targeting Colombian ships and, as of today, have struck in the Pacific as well. The president has claimed these attacks are driven by a desire to interdict drug smuggling, but he has suggested that he has this power under the global war on terror and what's referred to as the authorization of the use of military force that dates back to 9/11. On today's show, we will explore the use of the U.S. military in this so-called war on drugs, the nature of these attacks, and are they consistent with past U.S. policy? And are they legal, both under international law as well as under the Constitution? Our panel today is Gabor Rona. He is professor of the practice at Cardozo Law School. He's the author of Is There a Way Out of the Non-International Armed Conflict Detention Dilemma? State Responsibility to Respect, Protect, and Fulfill Human Rights Obligations in Cyberspace, and most recently, Venezuelan Boat Attacks. Utterly unprecedented and patently predictable. And Martin Brennan, he's associate professor at the School of Global Studies at Oklahoma State University. He's the author of COCA, Organized Crime and Nonviolence in Bolivia, and the co-author of The Criminalization of States, The Relationship Between States and Organized Crime. Thank you so much for joining us. And Gabor, I'll start with you in the first question, a deceptively simple one. Are these attacks legal?
Thank you, Doug. And the answer is non-deceptively simple. No, the attacks are not legal. But the reasons can get complex. And there are five basic reasons. Four of them are international law based, one of them is domestic law based. Let me take you through them. First of all, the administration has attempted to justify these attacks on the ground of what they call the right of self-defense. Under international law, there is a right to use force in self-defense, but it only applies in response to armed attacks. There's absolutely no question that the people on these boats were not engaged in any attack, let alone an armed attack against the United States. Second, the administration has labeled these people as narco-terrorists. That is also not a justification. Even if the designation is accurate, all that does is allow the government to impose financial sanctions, and then, if these people can be arrested, to prosecute them for their acts of terrorism. It does not justify targeted killing, extrajudicial executions. Third, the administration claims we are in an armed conflict against some organizations that are involved in these drug smuggling operations. That gets a bit more complicated because if the law of armed conflict does apply, then it creates an exception to human rights law rules that prohibit extrajudicial killing. In war, you can shoot at people and kill them, not because of what they're doing, not because of their conduct, but simply by virtue of their status as enemy combatants. However, you first have to establish that the legal criteria for armed conflict exist. And those legal criteria are essentially two things. One, there has to be an organized armed group that's capable of applying the laws of armed conflict. And it's questionable whether or not any individuals or entities that have been the target of these attacks are, in fact, an organized armed group. Chances are the answer to that is no, there really aren't. But more important, the second criteria is that there have to first be either severe or sustained hostilities before one reaches the threshold for the law of armed conflict to apply. And again, the occupants of these boats have not commenced any armed attacks or hostilities against the United States. So the law of armed conflict does not and cannot apply. Even if it did apply, these people are not combatants. The law of armed conflict has a principle of distinction that prohibits targeting civilians. It only allows targeting combatants. Combatants are people who engage in armed attacks, hostilities. And again, these individuals on these boats have done no such thing. So, whatever way you slice it from the perspective of applicable international law, there's no justification for these attacks. Let me also say there's a reason why the laws are the way they are. If we didn't have these guardrails that prohibit extrajudicial execution, then anything and everything can be war. In other words, it would simply eviscerate what are otherwise constitutional rights or human rights law rules that protect the right to life and that require due process of law for the deprivation of life and liberty. So then finally, on the domestic front, you mentioned the 2001 authorization for use of military force. That by its own terms, designated Al-Qaeda and those who harbor or protect Al-Qaeda as being the enemy in a situation in which Congress has authorized the president to use force. Again, none of those circumstances exist here. Nobody is accusing Trendaragua or anybody else involved in alleged drug trafficking on boats in the Caribbean or the Pacific to either be associated with Al-Qaeda or to be harboring Al-Qaeda. So again, no matter how you cut it, under international or domestic law, these attacks are unlawful, and they are unlawful for very good reasons.
And Martin Brennan, the U.S. has been fighting this so-called war on drugs. And so the language calling it the war on drugs obviously has implications. And it seems like these attacks are at least tied to this designation. Has the U.S. used its military traditionally in fighting drug interdiction or the flow of drugs into the United States? Is the use of the Navy in particular here, is there a precedent for this?
The use of the Navy is new, but the involvement of the United States military is not exactly new because we've been involved in the training and arming with actual boots on the ground in Bolivia, in Colombia, in a variety of other places for many, many years under Plan Colombia and a variety of other initiatives. We've had the DEA on the ground in a number of these countries as well. We operated a forward base, an Air Force base in Ecuador until not that very long ago, and that was all in the service of the war on drugs. So that involvement's been around for a long time. We've had indirect involvement of the Air Force and former Air Force pilots in Peru as well, over the Amazon, and of course Coast Guard in trying to intercept drugs as they were being trafficked from mostly Colombia to then Miami. And now, of course, there are other routes through that go through Mexico. But so the involvement of the American military is not exactly new. And you have to keep in mind that after 1990, after the fall of the Iron Curtain, for a while there, for about 11 years until 9/11, it was the war on drugs that was one of the principal pillars of American foreign policy. That drove a lot of what we did. With the Soviet Union gone, we had to find a new enemy, and drugs were enemy number one for a while there. So that involvement is not exactly new. What is new is having a naval detachment off the coast of Venezuela. What's also new is the targeting of Venezuela, because Venezuela is a minor player in this war on drugs. It's a minor player in terms of drug trafficking to the United States. Venezuelans are more involved in drug trafficking to Europe. But in terms of the total, like, they're not a producer. They don't produce fentanyl. They don't produce cocaine. They just mostly traffic a bunch of Colombian cocaine and maybe some heroin, but that's mostly it.
Gabor, for this question as well, this legality question, I know a number of figures, including some unlikely voices like Senator Rand Paul, have raised questions about it seems like the U.S. policy is fire first, ask questions later. If the U.S. Navy was apprehending individuals for the purposes of putting them on trial, does that make it legal at that point? So the real issue here is to kind of shoot first and then say, trust us, they had drugs, as opposed to seizing the boat and then showing that the boat had drugs.
I guess that's exactly why the administration has tried to shoehorn these attacks into a law of armed conflict framework. Because in war, there's no judge, there's no jury, there's no trial, you just shoot. While the involvement of the military, I agree, is not a new thing, the involvement of the military in a shoot first and ask questions later mode is what's patently illegal. If the United States interdicts drug smugglers on the high seas bound for the United States, there's really no impediment. There is well-settled U.S. law that would enable U.S. law enforcement officials or the military to interdict, to detain, to charge, and to try individuals for whatever drug offenses they may be suspected of. There's nothing wrong with that. What is wrong is the summary execution aspect of what's happened here. And I suppose we'll get to the fact that one of these recent attacks involved two individuals who were not killed, but who were picked up by military officials. And then the question became, what does the US do with them? Do you want to go into that now, Doug?
It'd be a, yeah, absolutely. I think it'd be great. Tell us about
Okay.
that case.
So, yeah, there was one of these boat attacks, certainly intending that the boat and its contents and everyone on it should be obliterated, but there were two survivors. And as is required by international law, the military picked up the survivors at sea. And then the question became, well, what does the United States do with these individuals? Well, if indeed, as President Trump has said, that each one of these boats is responsible for 25,000 deaths, and I may be getting the numbers wrong, but he said something ridiculously provocative like that. Then, at the very least, what you would want to do if you capture these individuals is to charge them with crimes and put them on trial. Instead, what happened was, within very short order, the US government decided to repatriate these individuals to their home countries. Why would that be? I think the obvious answer is because even if there might have been sufficient evidence to charge them with crimes, the circumstances under which they were taken into custody were so rife with illegality that the cooler heads within the US administration recognized that this would be a nightmare when and if these people actually came before a court. And of course, they would have the right to habeas corpus, the right to have their detention reviewed. Even Guantanamo detainees in the so-called War on Terror did, according to the Supreme Court's Boumediene decision back in 2008. And so I think the government recognized that they've really just stepped into an untenable situation because they know that they cannot support and justify the allegations of the grounds on which these attacks were conducted for the reasons that I said earlier. And I think an analogous case in point, it may come as a surprise to some people, but the individuals that the US has had in custody charged with the 9/11 attacks still haven't been put on trial. And even though they're being put through a military justice system that is much less protective of rights of due process than the civilian courts are. And the reason that we're 20 plus years out and still haven't been able to put these people on trial is because so many violations were committed against them. They were detained in ways that did not comport with international law. They were interrogated in ways that constituted torture. And these illegalities present a very severe obstacle to putting them on trial. So, analogously, in this case, where you have attacks that don't comport with any recognized theory of international law, that also don't comport with any requirement of congressional authorization, I think the administration recognized it would be a nightmare to try to put these people on trial. And that's why they were released. Now, what scares me at this point is that instead of learning the appropriate lesson that these attacks are unlawful, I fear that what the administration might learn is that when we conduct these attacks, we should make sure that no one survives. And that would be a rank war crime in the context of an armed conflict. In Nuremberg, German commanders were even prosecuted and sent to prison for the crime of ordering that no quarter shall be given to survivors of shipwrecks. So there is very much on point precedent on that. But I do fear that that may be the next step that the administration will want to take in order to protect its ability to continue to conduct these unlawful strikes.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're talking about the U.S. attacks, particularly the naval attacks against ships off the coast of Venezuela and Colombia under the guise of the war on drugs or perhaps the war on terror. Our guests are Gabor Rona from Cardozo Law School and Martin Brannon of Oklahoma State University. And Martin, during the 90s, I know the U.S., and you had highlighted this with Plan Colombia, et cetera, that the U.S. had increased its military presence in fighting this war on drugs. I mean, there was evidence, of course, there was a lot of drugs flowing out of Colombia, tied to Colombia's civil war, and, et cetera. But is that still the case? I mean, how much are the governments themselves in these countries? First of all, are the amount of drugs flowing out of South America, are they greater than they were in the 90s? Are they less? Generally speaking, is this still as big of an issue as it was in the 90s?
It's a much larger issue than it was in the 1990s. We're talking about Colombia, but the original producer of cocaine is, of course, Peru. Then production moved to Bolivia in the 1950s. Because we put pressure on Peru, and then afterwards we put pressure on Bolivia in the 1960s, and production moved to Colombia, where it was not a traditional crop. And in Colombia, the great advantage for drug traffickers was that Colombia is it was in a state of civil war, and there were whole chunks of the territory that the government didn't actually control. So when the United States government then goes to the Colombian government and says, "Hey, will you crack down on cocaine production?" The Colombian government could say, well, we can't. We don't actually control the national territory entirely. Think of it this way. In the 1980s, we had the crack epidemic, right? That's where you have crack cocaine everywhere, and it became a huge issue. And we started incarcerating people in very large numbers, et cetera. But you have to remember that at the peak of the crack epidemic, 1988, 1989, maybe 1990, at the peak of this crack problem, the amount of fatal overdoses in the United States never exceeded 1700 or thereabouts in a year, never exceeded that. We reached 112,000 in 2023. So obviously drugs are a much, much bigger problem than they were. And yeah, the amount of cocaine flowing out of Colombia has increased since the 1990s. It's absolutely true. Colombia is still the major producer of cocaine. Although Peru and Bolivia also play a role, Colombia remains the number one producer of cocaine by a very large margin. Just keep in mind, there are effectively three countries producing this. Peru, Bolivia, and Colombia. Colombia is by far the largest. It has the largest territory. It's still in a state of armed conflict with the ELN. And, whole chunks of the former rebel movement, FARC, effectively become a drug trafficking organization with a headquarters right next door in Ecuador, because Ecuador is dollarized and it's very attractive for these organizations to be there. It also has a much weaker government. We've spent billions upon billions of dollars trying to give the Colombian government the ability to crack down on this, billions of dollars in. We've done aerial spraying, we've had boots on the ground, we still send missions there. It's a very big problem. And then you have that other question: is the Colombian government involved in this? And what I'm not going to do is sit here and say, oh, the Colombian government is a drug trafficking organization. I'm not going to say that. But what I am going to say is that the Colombian government has a serious problem with corruption, and that's fairly widespread throughout the region. The Bolivian government has this problem as well, and so does the Peruvian government, and so, for that matter, does the Mexican government. Every once in a while, we'll arrest like we did a couple of years ago, we arrested the Mexican drug czar on drug trafficking charges, and that sort of thing is fairly common and happens a lot. I mean, direct government involvement, no, but are there bits and pieces of the Colombian government that are involved in the trafficking of drugs? Like, yes, very much so. And if we're looking at Venezuela, then I can go a step further and say that the Venezuelan military is effectively a drug trafficking organization. That's effectively what it does. So is there involvement? Yes, there is, through corruption. And think of it this way: ultimately, for all three of these countries, cocaine is one of their biggest sources of income. It is ultimately, economically, when you think about it, it isn't exactly in Peru's best interest to undermine one of its largest economic sectors. It's a counterintuitive thing to do. And the only reason that Colombia was the one country that always enthusiastically assisted in that enthusiastically worked with the United States to crack down on drug traffickers was because Colombia was in a state of civil war, and rebel groups used money from cocaine to go to war, to buy weapons, and to blow up police stations, etc. So since the Colombian government had an existential threat against it from rebel groups that made their money through the trafficking of drugs, that's the primary reason that the Colombian government was the one government in Latin America that was actually enthusiastic about working with the United States in this war on drugs.
Now, you did highlight cocaine as the primary drug that's flowing out of this region, but the president keeps citing fentanyl. Is fentanyl being produced in this part of the world? And how much is fentanyl? Are we mostly talking about the cocaine trade?
So, Colombia is a major producer of cocaine and a minor producer of heroin. Venezuela probably produces a little bit of heroin, but there's not a whole lot of evidence for that. Mostly they're trafficking Colombian drugs. Fentanyl makes its way into the United States these days through Mexico. Fentanyl is a synthetic drug. It's a synthetic opioid. It was invented by Paul Janssen in 1959. It's been on the market since then. It's used for breakthrough pain in cancer patients. That's what it's historically for. And the thing about fentanyl is that it's an incredibly, incredibly strong drug. It's a much stronger drug than heroin, but it is an opioid. So it has the same effect. You just need a lot less of it. And then, in addition to fentanyl, we have literally hundreds of fentanyl analogs, like 3-methylfentanyl, which is even stronger than that. And yes, fentanyl is a huge problem because, as I said, the amount of fatal overdoses in the United States has gone up from 1,500-ish in the mid-80s to 112,000 in 2023. And that increase in overdose is almost entirely attributable to the appearance of fentanyl. So fentanyl taking over really around 2013. It's become a huge problem, and it's being added to all kinds of other drugs. And it's just so powerful. It's such a powerful drug that you need an industrial scale to weigh that in doses that aren't dangerous. It's a very difficult drug to work with, which is why so many people overdose on the stuff. And that's the primary drug now. So that's a huge problem, but it's not coming out of Colombia. Colombia is not a producer of fentanyl. It could become one because it's not a difficult drug to synthesize, but right now it's mostly coming in from Mexico, and that's since China started cracking down on its production of fentanyl and fentanyl analogs a number of years ago under American pressure. So that manufacturing simply moved to Mexico, where you had existing drug smuggling operations that said, well, I guess we can make this here as well then, just like they did a number of years before with the methamphetamine, right? I'm sure you remember that we used to have home cooks for methamphetamines, and now we don't anymore, and it's because you can't buy pseudoephedrine, Sudafed, in large quantities at the drugstore anymore, like you could in the early 2000s. And since we've taken that off the market largely, that production also moved to Mexico. So the fentanyl is very much a Mexican problem, not a Colombian one.
Right. So, Gabor, that then seems to raise the question then. The U.S. is targeting Venezuela, targeting Colombia, stating that it's fentanyl, even though that's really not the drug that's coming out of there. And there's been some real concerns that the real problem of fentanyl use and overdoses in the U.S. is being used as a bit of a fig leaf for military operations off the coast of Venezuela and Colombia. I guess my question is, how accurate is that the administration seems to be using one very legitimate problem to potentially be implementing a policy that really doesn't address that problem, but maybe has other motivations?
So I'm taking off my lawyer hat now, and that puts me on a little bit shakier ground. But I think it comes as no surprise to anybody that the Trump administration has expressed, all manners of animosity against President Maduro and the Venezuelan regime. It seems hard to avoid the conclusion that these drug attacks are anything but a means of fomenting armed conflict rather than responding to armed conflict in the case of U.S.-Venezuelan relations. You might ask, well, does that still hold true in light of the fact that the U.S. is now going after drug boats in the Pacific, ones that don't originate from Venezuela? My sense is that those attacks are merely an alibi for the true intent of the administration, which is to scare up hostilities in connection with Venezuela. And much like other U.S. military adventures over the course of the last, 50 to 100 years, these things usually end in tears for both the victim states and their inhabitants, but also for the United States as well. The effort to, in effect, conduct foreign policy through gunboats is simply something that is rightfully relegated to the past under international law. Ever since the end of the Second World War, we've had a United Nations charter that prohibits states from not only using force, but even from threatening force in their international relations, as the Trump administration has done against Venezuela. The ability of the world order to essentially, graduate from the type of hostilities that occurred in the earlier part of the 20th century, the First World War, the Second World War, hopefully those kinds of wars are in the past, although Russia-Ukraine creates some questions about that. But as a matter of international law, what the drafters of the UN Charter attempted to do is to close the book on threats of use of force and the use of force in international relations, obviously, in order to give us a more peaceful world. And the United States simply is continuing to either toy around the edges, or go full frontal in attempting to destroy this rules-based international order to the detriment of everyone on planet Earth when it threatens use of force or when it uses force in an aggressive fashion against another state.
When we come back, are the U.S. military's attacks on ships near Venezuela and Colombia some type of gunboat diplomacy? And how will these attacks affect the U.S.'s image in the region? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The United States has argued that it has attacked ships carrying drugs to the United States. Is there a growing demand for drugs in the U.S.? And if so, what is driving it? And would attacks on these boats actually address the issue? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Our guests today are Gabor Rona. He's professor of the practice at Cardozo Law School. And Martin Brannon. He's associate professor at the School of Global Studies at Oklahoma State University. Before the break, we were talking about what this impact, what the legal impact of, you know, the U.S. and the use of force, and started to talk a bit more about what this means for U.S. policy and U.S. role in this part of the world. Martin, the idea that the U.S. is using the military covertly, overtly, et cetera, this isn't new in the region. What's the historical context of the Trump administration's policy in using the military in this region of the world?
Well, I mean, the word gunboat diplomacy sort of comes from U.S. involvement. I mean, the United States has been involved or meddled in Latin American domestic politics for an exceedingly long time. We've had a number of regimes supported by the United States with force, and we've had a number of regimes that we've overthrown with American help. Of course, we had the Contras in Nicaragua, who were supported by the United States somewhat covertly, but not really. We had the overthrow of Jacobo Arbenz in 1954 in Guatemala. We had U.S. involvement in attempting to overthrow the Fidel Castro regime on a number of occasions, using sometimes quite overt force with the Bay of Pigs, for example. This involvement in Latin American affairs led to an actual nuclear standoff with the Soviet Union. So we've done this for a long time. For anybody who's a little younger, you wouldn't necessarily have a good memory of that, because there was less of it in the 21st century, so much so that the Obama administration was kind of accused of ignoring Latin America and not paying very much attention to it, because the focus was so much more on the Pacific. But the United States has a very long story. Well, the overthrow of Allende in Chile, for example, and replacing him with Pinochet, and it was the American hand in that. And then in the execution of the war on drugs. I mean, we've had military bases in the region. We had one in Ecuador. There was talk of one in Colombia. We've had Americans training Latin American militaries through the School of the Americas, which was, of course, in the Panama Canal originally, and training them to do some fairly horrendous things. We had Plan Condor, where the United States was involved in setting up a collaboration between the 1970s, 1960s and 70s Latin American dictatorial regimes, where they came to an agreement that, you know, that subversives in exile would be persecuted by the country where they were in exile. So, I mean, there's been a lot of involvement. And I just have to say, like, yes, I would say that almost none of that was, strictly speaking, legal, and almost none of that was in observance of the United Nations Charter. Like, we've involved ourselves in the internal politics of Latin American countries for a very, very long time. It's not new. I mean, this is a little different because we've got this naval detachment blowing up ships, and that's That's new, but in the late 90s and early 2000s, we had CIA planes tracking airplanes in air bridge denial, in our air bridge denial programs, also leading to the shooting down of civilian airplanes. Like that's in 2001, we had one of those.
Gabor, I want to bring you back in to talk about why does this question about legality matter, in particular when thinking about certainly President Trump has never been one to champion international law. What does that mean for the American position in the world, American leadership? And of course, how precedent or unprecedented is this that I don't think it's controversial to say that President Trump is not terribly interested in the advancement of international law. But is he unique for American presidents, or have American presidents typically been much less interested in ensuring that American policies align with international law?
So let me briefly say, first of all, why it matters. There is a direct through line from these boat attacks to the questions of law that pervade the conduct of Russia in Ukraine, the conduct of Israel in Gaza. And to the extent we want to preserve this post-World War II rules-based international order that prohibits states from using aggressive force in violation of the law, that prohibits the commission of war crimes, even when use of force is permissible under international law, then we simply cannot try to justify these boat attacks without throwing out any arguments that we may have for the wisdom, the utility, and the humanity of obeying the rule of law in connection with Russia's aggression against Ukraine, in connection with Israeli war crimes that have been committed in Gaza. As far as precedent is concerned, a lot of the folks in the kind of expert legal world that have opined on these boat attacks that I've been reading about have noted how much of a departure these attacks are, not only from law, but from previous U.S. practice and policy. And I agree that they are a gross departure from law. I do not agree that they are a gross departure from prior U.S. practice and policy. Every administration since 9/11 has taken significant liberties with applicable international law as far as targeting and detention authorities are concerned. Let me start with, you mentioned at the beginning, Doug, the very concept of global war on terror. We don't have video, so it doesn't show, but I'm putting that in scare quotes right now. There is no such thing as a global war on terror any more than there is a global war on cancer, or for that matter, a global war on drugs. We don't shoot to kill people with cancer. We don't shoot to kill executives of tobacco companies. And likewise, we can't shoot to kill drug dealers. But the precedent that the Bush administration created in touting this concept of global war on terror clouds the distinction between what is and isn't war. Let me try to make it really simply clear. You can have wars against proper nouns, Al-Qaeda, Germany, Japan. You can't have wars against common nouns, terror, terrorism, drugs, drug smuggling. The reason is that the laws of war carry responsibilities for the parties to the armed conflict. That's how the rule of law is implemented. Common nouns like terrorism or drugs or cancer have no capacity to comply with laws of war. Therefore, you can't have wars against them. And yet, By eliding this distinction, the Bush administration not only commenced a war against Al-Qaeda or the Taliban or Afghanistan, which it may have been totally legally justified in doing, but then spread that war to include anyone that the administration considered to be a terrorist or a member of a terrorist organization. And in doing so, they crossed a Rubicon, they crossed a line that that international law does not permit. But once we crossed that line, we also attempted to justify law of armed conflict rules concerning those people that we had no business of saying we were at war against. We tried to justify extrajudicial killings of people. We tried to justify arbitrary detention without due process of law against such people. We tried to justify targeting people simply because they were military-age males, as opposed to because we had evidence that they were directly participating in hostilities. That's why we ended up targeting so many weddings in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Yemen. And so these unwarranted expansions of the practice that the United States engaged in connection with post-9/11 conflict, were very much the foundation for what the Trump administration is doing today, taking liberties with the applicability of the law of armed conflict, taking liberties with the concept of the right to use force in self-defense in international law, taking liberties with the notion of who is a combatant in an armed conflict versus a civilian. So all of these things that the Trump administration is attempting to use as justifications for its present policy have their origins and their foundation in post-9/11 practices and policies of every U.S. government, Republican and Democratic, since 9/11.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about the U.S. naval attacks off the coasts of Venezuela and Colombia, the war on drugs, linkages potentially to the war on terror. Our guests today are Gabor Rona of Cardozo Law School and Martin Brannon of Oklahoma State University. On this last section here, Martin, we've been talking a lot about what's legal, what's the precedent for all of this, but your research, is focused on U.S. cooperation, U.S. policy in the region, and the war on drugs. So I'm going to ask a slightly different question. Not is it legal, but how effective is the policy? Is this use of the military as a way to try to stem the flow of drugs? So I guess the question is, what have been the most effective tools historically, and what could be the most effective tools at actually addressing the question about drug flows coming out of the region?
Ooh, are you asking me to solve the drug problem right now? Because
I'm at least,
if
I'm not
I
asking you to
do, I think
solve
I'm
it as
getting
much as
an
at least give us some insights.
I'm thinking if I do that successfully, I'm going to get a Nobel Prize. But
I'd nominate you.
let's be clear. We're not winning the war on drugs, not even remotely. And the metric that I would use to bring that point home is the simple fact that the number of overdose deaths has exploded and not gone down, that the amount of drugs flowing into the United States has gone up, not down, and that the and if you want a nice economic metric for this, what you look at is the price of drugs. And I can tell you that cocaine is much cheaper now than it was in the 1970s when we started the war on drugs, right? And if you think about what a war on drugs is, then what you're trying to do is stem the flow of drugs into the country. That's what you're trying to do. And if you do that successfully, then any economist will tell you that if you do that successfully, if you limit the supply, then the price will go up. That's what will happen. And that's where one of the fundamental problems is. The more successful you are at executing this war on drugs, the more profitable you make it for people to participate in the smuggling of drugs. Right? It's a fundamental economic problem that you can't get around. So, I mean, has it been effective? No, it's been the exact opposite. I mean, let me give you the fentanyl example. You can ask yourself, why would anyone inject themselves with fentanyl when there's a good chance that it'll kill you? And the answer is very simple. Fentanyl is much stronger, and because it's much stronger, it's easier to smuggle, right? So it's called the Iron Law of Prohibition. It's this observation from the prohibition on alcohol, of course, in the 1920s and early 30s, where one of the observations was that there was this switch from beer and wine to hard liquor that took place during Prohibition for the simple reason that it's easier to smuggle because it's stronger. And the same applies to the smuggling of drugs. Right? So people have switched to fentanyl because fentanyl is much easier to get into the country. And now, if you want to understand how big of a problem this is, then let me give you this example. There are many, many fentanyl analogs, but the thing to remember is they all effectively do the same. It's just some are more effective at crossing the blood-brain barrier than others. One of the stronger ones that you can make, which is not difficult to make, is called 3-methylfentanyl. Okay, 3-methylfentanyl. It's just a fentanyl analog, but it's very, very strong. And when I say it's very, very strong, what I mean to say is that from 1 gram of 3-methylfentanyl is enough to make somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million doses for individuals to take, right? And you know, thousands upon thousands of containers enter ports in the United States, in New Jersey and in Seattle and in Los Angeles, every day, in Miami, every day, thousands upon thousands. And I can guarantee you that somebody can hide a couple of grams of 3-methylfentanyl in a container, and you will never, ever in your life ever find it, right? That's the biggest issue with this. What you want to address is consumption, but that one's is difficult as well, because the United States has certainly tried its darndest to convince people to not take drugs. We throw people in jail for very long periods of time for the use of drugs, and that hasn't been particularly successful. Cocaine is a popular drug, and you know, fentanyl has become a popular drug. The fentanyl one worries me a great deal because it is trivially easy to make. It's not difficult to get the ingredients to make the precursors for it. And effectively, anybody with a bit of chemistry background can make this stuff, right? So we've had labs pop up every once in a while in the United States that put this stuff out, because the issue with it is that the profit margins are just so enormous, right? The profit margins are enormous, and that's especially true for fentanyl, because it's not expensive to make, and you need a very, very, very tiny amount of it to make large quantities of money, right? And cocaine with cocaine let me give you the example of cocaine. Like, why is cocaine such a big problem? And to be fair, not very many people overdose on cocaine. It's not you can, but you have to really, really try. It's not that dangerous a drug, certainly not compared to fentanyl. A kilogram of cocaine, if you buy it at the market in Biatunari, Bolivia, which is in the Chapare, which is a region where coca is grown and cocaine is produced, it'll set you back. A kilogram of it, of the raw material, will set you back, you know, $1,200, maybe $1,500. And if you sell that retail here in the United States, it's $150,000 to $300,000. Like, that's the issue. You can find somebody, and if you simply make it more illegal, if you do what the country of Brunei says, if we catch you with any of this stuff, we're going to kill you. And they will do that. They will hang you. Okay, what that does is it simply drives up the price. So in Brunei, a kilogram of cocaine is worth about $1.4 million. That's the difference. And you can find somebody who will smuggle in a kilogram of cocaine if you promise them $1 million. Like that's so I'm afraid that I do not have some sort of simple solution for you. Right? We've thrown military. The problem with throwing military training at this is this. To give you just another example, because I do work with the United States Air Force every once in a while to provide some insight into this. And I get this question frequently, like, what can we do to enhance the capabilities of the Colombian military or the Mexican military or some Latin American military? And then I have to ask this question. Are you sure you want to do that? Are you sure you want to enhance their capabilities? Right? Because we trained a whole set of Mexican special forces, anti-drug special forces. We trained them using military training, using military bases, brought them here, gave them special forces training. They went back, and those are the people who called themselves the Zetas. We trained them. We did it. And they became, for a while there, the most violent and one of the most powerful drug trafficking organizations in Mexico. We trained them to do it. So it's tricky. And the same with the Colombian military. Like the Colombian military is the primary force that we use to fight drug trafficking organizations in Colombia, and there's dozens of them. But the problem is that there are also these individuals that are part of the Colombian military who sometimes participate in this activity. And so it's a very difficult problem.
And so now you've highlighted there's a market-based concern. There's concerns about the empowerment of militaries that the U.S. is engaged in. Gabor, Ron, I'm going to give you the last word on this. A risk that we haven't talked as much about but needs to be addressed then is the risk to the U.S. military personnel themselves who are being asked to carry out these types of attacks. We've already raised the question. We've got some skepticism, if not downright don't believe this is going to be terribly successful, but there's an additional risk to this type of policy. What is that risk?
I don't think it's a military risk. I doubt very much that military personnel will be at physical risk in these remote kinds of attacks, although it's possible. But what we're seeing in the kind of larger picture of the Trump administration's treatment of the military does not bode well. Secretary Hegseth fired all of the top lawyers for each of the military branches who give advice to operations on the legality of any particular attack. This advice is supposed to be given before an attack, not afterwards. But having fired the judge advocate generals, there is now a lacuna, just a gap in this requirement of the Geneva Conventions, by the way, that legal advice be applied to military operations in advance. The Department of Defense, Secretary Hegseth also denigrates the concept of rules of engagement. He has promoted this, I can't think of any word other than infantile, notion of warrior ethos at the expense of the operation legal obligations. There's a reason we have these legal obligations. And as I mentioned, it has largely to do with protecting people who should not be the object of hostilities, but it also protects the people who conduct the hostilities. To the extent that military personnel are now engaging in violations of international law, they become susceptible to prosecution. Now, maybe they won't be prosecuted in or by the United States at any time in the foreseeable future. But if I'm the lawyer for one of the individual members of the military who's involved in these attacks, I would strongly advise them to avoid traveling to other countries, Europe, Latin America, African countries, places where there is already established precedent for the exercise of what is called universal jurisdiction. That is, when international crimes are committed, any state has the prerogative, and in some instances under the Geneva Conventions, even the obligation to prosecute those individuals, even if their crimes had nothing to do with the country that is doing the prosecuting. And so I think individual members of the military who are involved in these patently unlawful attacks very much risk the possibility that they could come to the attention of criminal justice authorities in other countries, or in some instances, potentially to the attention of the International Criminal Court, and possibly end up on the receiving end of prosecutions for their involvement in these activities. The evisceration of the legal function in the military is partly at the expense of those that are targeted by the military, but it is also at the expense of those who do the targeting.
I think that's a great place to end. Our panel today has been Gabor Rona. He's a professor of practice at Cardozo Law School. He's the author of Is There a Way Out of Non-International Armed Conflict Detention Dilemma and State Responsibility to Protect, to Respect, Protect, and Fulfill Human Rights Obligations in Cyberspace, as well as most recently, Venezuelan Boat Attacks, Utterly Unprecedented and Patently Predictable. And Martin Brannon, he is Associate Professor at the School of Global Studies at Oklahoma State University. He's the author of COCA, Organized Crime and Nonviolence in Bolivia, and co-author of The Criminalization of States, The Relationship Between States and Organized Crime. Thank you both so much for sharing your time and your expertise on this important issue.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on at Scholar Circle or me at Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.